After all that occurred in the salvation of Caesar by the Jews in Alexandria, Hyrcanus surely interpreted the state of affairs as one in which Jewish Jerusalem and his own power would be revived for many years through Caesar. But all that disappeared when the blood of Caesar fell on the Senate floor. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 59, Julius and Jerusalem. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. Why, man, he doth bestride the narrow world like a colossus, and we petty men walk under his huge legs and peep about to find ourselves dishonorable graves. Men at times are masters of their fates. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves that we are underlings. Brutus and Caesar, what should be in that, Caesar? Why should that name be sounded more than yours? Write them together, yours is as fair a name. Sound them, it doth become the mouth as well. Weigh them, it is as heavy. Conjure with him, Brutus will start a spirit as soon as Caesar. Now in the names of all the gods at once, upon what meat doth this our Caesar feed, that he is grown so great? So Cassius famously monologues in the opening of Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. The monologue describes the might achieved by Caesar following the fall of his rivals, but also reflects the events that will lead to his assassination. Julius Caesar is one of the most famous political figures in the history of the world, but less well known is the role that the Jews of Jerusalem played in his rise. It is a fascinating facet of the story of Jerusalem, one which can further enhance our wonder at the history of an eternal people. With the death of Marcus Crassus, the former first triumvirate was reduced to two members, Pompey and Caesar, and one of the most famous of phrases is given to us by Roman history in the context of Caesar's choice to advance his army on Rome and to seize power all for himself. Again, Plutarch, quote, "When he came to the river which separates Cisalpine Gaul from the rest of Italy, it is called the Rubicon, and began to reflect, now that he drew nearer to the fearful step and was agitated by the magnitude of his ventures, he checked his speed. Then, halting in his course, he communed with himself a long time in silence, as his resolution wavered back and forth, and his purpose then suffered change after change. For a long time, too, he discussed his perplexities with his friends who were present. Among them was Asinius Pollio, estimating the great evils for all mankind, which would follow their passage of the river, and the wide fame of it, which they would leave to posterity. But finally, with a sort of passion, as if abandoning calculation and casting himself upon the future, and uttering the phrase with which men usually prelude their plunge into desperate and daring fortunes, 'Let the die be cast,' he hastened to cross the river." End quote. Caesar marched into Rome, his troops sweeping into the city, as Pompey, in Plutarch's words, quote, "forsook the city, commanding the Senate to follow, and forbidding anyone to remain who preferred country and freedom to tyranny," end quote. But not everyone apparently followed Pompey's order, for there were seemingly still residents in Rome loyal to Pompey, and these Romans dramatically impacted the future of the Hasmonean family. Recall that during the Hasmonean Civil War, Pompey had not only taken Jerusalem and the temple, he had also captured Shlomtzion's son, Aristobulus. This Hasmonean prince was then imprisoned in Rome by Pompey, and upon Caesar seizing complete control of the city, he freed Aristobulus and armed him, no doubt in the knowledge that Aristobulus' rival, Hyrcanus, had allied himself with Pompey. Aristobulus might have taken the arms and troops accorded him by Caesar in order to try to take Jerusalem, but the freeing of Aristobulus was an act to which those in the Pompey faction of Rome reacted very negatively. Josephus writes, quote, "But sometime afterwards, Caesar, when he had taken Rome, and after Pompey and the Senate were fled beyond the Ionian Sea, freed Aristobulus from his bonds, and resolved to send him into Syria, and deliver two legions to him, that he might set matters right, as being a potent man in that country. But Aristobulus had no enjoyment of what he hoped for from the power that was given him by Caesar, for those of Pompey's party prevented it, and destroyed him by poison, and those of Caesar's party buried him. His dead body also lay for a good while embalmed in honey, till Antony afterwards sent it to Judea and caused him to be buried in the royal sepulchre. Thus died Aristobulus, son of Alexander, Ioneus, and Shlomtzion." This grisly description, as we will see in later episodes, will not be the only case where we find a story of a Hasmonean encased in honey. Pompey, escaping to Egypt, was killed there. And with Caesar arriving in Egypt, he chose to take sides in a civil war, dividing the Ptolemaic dynasty, supporting the princess who would become perhaps the most famous queen on earth, Cleopatra, against her brother Ptolemy. Ptolemy's forces besieged Caesar at Alexandria, and the siege was undone through the Battle of Pelusium, waged by Caesar's ally, the nobleman Mithridates of Pergamus. And here, for our purposes, is where it gets really interesting. For Josephus tells us that following the death of Pompey, Hyrcanus in Jerusalem switched his allegiance over to Caesar and sent, through his friend Antipater, a large number of troops to support Mithridates and save Caesar at Alexandria. Josephus writes, quote, "Now after Pompey was dead and after that victory Caesar had gained over him, Antipater, who managed the Jewish affairs, became very useful to Caesar when he made war against Egypt, and that by the order of Hyrcanus. For when Mithridates of Pergamus was bringing his auxiliaries and was not able to continue his march through Pelusium, but obliged to stay at Ashkelon, Antipater came to him, conducting 3,000 of the Jews, armed men." End quote. It was, in other words, Jewish soldiers that helped break the siege at Alexandria through the Battle of Pelusium. And Josephus fascinatingly further informs us that Antipater then convinced the Jews in Egypt to switch over to Caesar's side, adding, quote, "But it happened that the Egyptian Jews who dwelt in the country called Onion would not let Antipater and Mithridates with their soldiers pass to Caesar. But Antipater persuaded them to come over with their party, because he was of the same people with them, and that chiefly by showing them the epistles of Hyrcanus the high priest, wherein he exhorted them to cultivate friendship with Caesar, and to supply his army with money, and all sorts of provisions which they wanted. And accordingly, when they saw Antipater and the high priest of the same sentiments, they did as they were desired. And when the Jews about Memphis heard that these Jews were come over to Caesar, they also invited Mithridates to come to them. So he came and received them also into his army." End quote. The contribution of Jewish Jerusalem to the survival of Caesar was thus enormous. Luciano Canfora, in his biography of Caesar, titles one chapter, "Caesar Saved by the Jews," writing, quote, "Caesar owed his salvation to the Jews, and this he never forgot." And Canfora adds, "There is a letter from Mithridates to Caesar acknowledging Antipater's decisive role in the battle and in the whole campaign. It is clear that Josephus is quoting a document, a letter to Caesar, which he knew of directly." End quote. Indeed, Josephus further informs us that Caesar richly rewarded his newfound allies in Jerusalem, writing that, quote, "Caesar appointed Hyrcanus to be high priest and gave Antipater what principality he himself should choose, leaving the determination to himself. So he made him procurator of Judea. He also gave Hyrcanus leave to raise up the walls of his own city upon his asking that favor of him, for they had been demolished by Pompey." And Josephus adds that Caesar issued the following decree, "I will that Hyrcanus, the son of Alexander, and his children be ethnarchs of the Jews, and have the high priesthood of the Jews forever, according to the customs of their forefathers, and that he and his sons be our confederates, and that besides this, every one of them be reckoned among our particular friends. I also ordain that he and his children retain whatsoever privileges belong to the office of high priest, or whatsoever favors have been hitherto granted them, and if at any time hereafter there arise any questions about the Jewish customs, I will that he determine the same." End quote. It is important to read this portion of the words of Julius Caesar's declaration in order to truly enter into the mindset of the Jews of Jerusalem at this time. Indeed, the mindset of the Jews throughout the Roman Empire. For at this moment, it must have seemed as if some version of a Hasmonean restoration had taken place in Jerusalem. The mightiest man on earth, Julius Caesar, had guaranteed the high priesthood eternally to Hyrcanus. He had made him ethnarch, prince of Jerusalem, charging him as well to make religious decisions in Jerusalem and to rebuild the walls of the sacred city that had been destroyed by Pompey. Caesar, furthermore, clearly felt enormously indebted to the Jews, and that must have endowed Jewish communities throughout the diaspora in the empire with a sense of security. Yet, with the hindsight of history, we know that all was not as secure as it seemed. First, while Hyrcanus was technically made the ruler of Jerusalem under Rome, his friend, Antipater, had been made procurator, placing him and, as we will see, his sons in positions of authority. Second, we know, as Hyrcanus did not, that Caesar was not long for this world, for with the Ides of March 44 BCE came the assassination of Caesar in the Senate. One is reminded in pondering this quick turn of affairs of a scene in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, where Caesar is warned on the morning of the Ides of March by his wife Calphurnia that she had a dream where she saw blood pouring out of Caesar's visage. Caesar remarks, "Calphurnia here, my wife, stays me at home. She dreamt tonight she saw my statue, which like a fountain with 100 spouts did run pure blood, and many lusty Romans came smiling and did bathe their hands in it. With these does she apply for warnings and portents, and evil's imminent, and on her knee hath begged that I will stay at home today." Caesar is then convinced by another that the dream is actually a positive one, symbolizing that Caesar would revive Rome. Caesar is told, "This dream is all a misinterpreted. It was a vision fair and fortunate. Your statue spouting blood in many pipes, in which so many smiling Romans bathed, signified that from you great Rome shall suck reviving blood, and that great men shall press for tinctures, stains, relics, and cognizance. This, by Calphurnia's dream, is signified." Caesar immediately and wrongly seizes on the positive interpretation, saying, "And this way have you well expounded it." Thus does Caesar in the play head off to the Senate, assured that a better interpretation of the vision has been offered. After all that occurred in the salvation of Caesar by the Jews in Alexandria, Hyrcanus surely interpreted the state of affairs as one in which Jewish Jerusalem and his own power would be revived for many years through Caesar. But all that disappeared when the blood of Caesar fell on the Senate floor. Historians further note that, fascinatingly, the Jews of Rome wept profoundly for Caesar, no doubt knowing how positively disposed he was toward the Jews, and perhaps intuiting correctly that not all those who followed Caesar would feel likewise. As for me, to paraphrase Shakespeare, I come in this episode not to bury Caesar or to praise him, but rather to retell an often forgotten episode in Jewish history, and to ponder and marvel at the fact that Jewish Jerusalem has had interactions with pharaohs, kings of Babylon and Persia, Alexander the Great, and Julius Caesar, and yet all the empires of those rulers who once bestrode the world like a colossus are no more, but Jewish Jerusalem is here. This is Mayor Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.